Hello, and welcome to the Burning Issue podcast. My name is Luke Walsh, and I'm the editor of the website endswasteandbioenergy.com. This podcast looks at what happens to the black bag waste people throw out and pretty much forget about as soon as it's collected. Traditionally, that waste was buried in landfill, but that's terrible for the environment due to the methane that leaks out, let alone all the other nastiness caught up in these dumps. So, over the past few decades, the UK has moved to energy from waste using traditional great combustion systems. But more recently, there was a move towards so-called advanced conversion technologies. These are more commonly known as gasification. However, when you say the word gasification to waste people, there's a sharp intake of breath as they think of previous failures like Air Products and Derby. But there are people out there making a success of the technology. One of those is Q Technology. And I'm talking to their Head of Sustainability, ESG and Policy, Amna Bizanti, who is also Commercial Manager of Circular Fuels. Let's hear what she has to say. Hello, Amna. Thank you very much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I think it's fair to say Q Technology has stayed somewhat under the radar, but you're firmly out in the market now. Can you tell us what's changed? Why now?
Indeed, we have. And I would say it was a deliberate choice due to our core philosophy shaped by our background, experience and motivations, which has been fundamental in forming our development and deployment strategy from the very beginning. And that beginning was actually just over 10 years ago now. So we've been around for quite a long while. However, I think the main reason we've not made too much noise to date is I don't think it's a secret to anyone that the gasification technology sector's history is not the best. In fact, due to that, I actually have my own definition of blue ocean strategy versus red ocean. Just in case anyone doesn't know, the blue ocean strategy is a business approach that typically advocates for creating new uncontested market spaces. You know, it emphasizes innovation, value creation, and tapping into new demand. Whereas red oceans are, you know, overcrowded industries of existing demands and services. However, for the gasification sector, I think it could be fair to say that the red ocean is less about existing products and technology and services and more about the blood, sweat and tears of the unfortunate failures that the sector has faced in its history. But I would say that's the history now. And in terms of the present and the future, not just Q Technology is an advanced gasification developer, but there are other gasification developers out there who have stayed resilient and are now pioneering the creation of advanced gasification technologies and deploying them commercially. And last but not least, I'll just end on a note to say for us and why we came to this conclusion and approach, it all started with our co-founders who came from a similar world of conversion technologies. So our CEO, Kamal Kelsey, who's also the brain behind our core IP, was heavily involved in assessment of conversion technologies and their due diligence before starting Q. And also our CTO, Hans Manschen, has over 30 years of gasification experience. So he's really lived the failures and some successes. One of the successes, I'd say, is the Varnamo plant, which ran on wastewood as well. So thanks to that, it really informed our approach. And it also meant we focused a lot more initially in proving we have something that works before putting focus on being known for who we are and what we're doing before we'd actually done it.
We'll talk later on about some of the failures, but if we could talk about some of the more positive things now. You're involved with some heavy hitters in the business known as Circular Fuels. Can you tell us a bit more about that, please?
So Circular Fuels Limited is a partnership between Q Technology ourselves and Dimeter. It's a wholly owned subsidiary by Dimeter as well. And the project development company that's developing construction-ready renewable and recycled carbon DME from waste production plants. And Dimeter, who I've mentioned, in itself is a joint venture between SHV Energy and UGI International. They're one of the top two leading companies worldwide in terms of LPG distribution and sale, etc., for off-grid energy. And what Dimeter was formed to address and focus on is advancing the production and use of renewable and recycled dimethyl ether, which is a low-carbon sustainable liquid gas and a substitute for LPG, could also be a substitute for diesel, and therefore RDME can be a great low-carbon solution for the LPG and off-grid energy industry generally, which is one of the hard-to-abate sectors.
With your Circular Fuels project, when it really got a lot of coverage was when Suez came on board. And that has to be a solid endorsement of your technology, as they've struggled in the past with gasification at their Surrey plant. How did a deal with Suez come about?
I think first I'll start with addressing one of the core points. As you mentioned, they've previously struggled with gasification, but I think it's fair to say that they had a lot of difficulty and challenges initially. But thanks to that, they now have a lot of lessons learned. And in that same facility they had struggles with, that's now become pretty much the best performing gasifier in the UK running on municipal solid waste. So I think despite them facing some challenges, I know they spent a lot of internal resources to resolve them. And therefore, they have a lot of know-how. And they're bringing that into the partnership with Q and Circular Fuels Limited. And just before I get into more about us and why they chose us, I think it's fair to focus on the point about Suez's adaptability and resilience and perseverance is key, because it enabled them to navigate the challenges, evolve amidst the change, and persist despite the obstacles, and they made it work. And now they have that valuable know-how, they have that valuable track record, and combined with Q's technology, and we can talk a bit more about the fact that we have a commercial scale demonstration facility in the Midlands called our Sustainable Energy Centre. That combined with the fact that we also had an existing operational plant, which helped assure Suez that there's something there. So now that there's forces of us and Suez coming together with their valuable know-how, lessons learned, and then we have the technology which is working and operating and building its track record, Suez coming in this part of the journey is really valuable in terms of they will support us to get it right. And, you know, no single person or company can solve the climate change emergency alone, so collaboration is key. So we're very grateful to be able to have them on board for that.
You're completely right about the Surrey plant. I saw they put in a permit variation application recently to add another 6,000 tonnes to it. So it must be working reasonably well now. It does bring me on to ask about the feedstock sourcing. People have said that's becoming a problem as there's more EFW plants coming online. So how does Q tackle it? Does it work with Suez, or do you have another angle on it?
So in terms of feedstock sourcing and availability, I think especially now where we're still, first of all, still landfilling a lot, but increasingly with increased capacity of EFW plants, but then you're also hearing a lot about waste to X, you know, advanced molecules production from waste coming online. So feedstock competition is becoming one of the biggest challenges for any developer in this space. And for us, first and foremost, I'd say we rely a lot on one of our key technology advantages, which is feedstock flexibility. And thanks to that, we're able to take from MSW to low-grade biomass, so, you know, nickel-rich biomass or sewage sludges or forestry and agricultural residues or pulp and paper waste from industrial processes. One of the ways we overcome it is we have feedstock flexibility. But regardless, any advanced gasification technology, it needs a lot of preparation. And what we as Q are not are feedstock sources, collectors, or we're not a waste management company, such as Suez or other waste management company players. So for us, whereas we have the technology advantage of being able to take multiple feedstocks, we put a lot of focus on effort in creating the right feedstock partnerships that can help us source it, but not only source it, but prepare it in the right form so that a gasification process can take it. And that is where partnerships like Suez working on understanding, okay, what's the spec requirement? What's the, you know, physical requirement of preparation, etc., and working collaboratively to make that happen and realize project. And that, as a result, also helps us with the feedstock competition and sourcing, because a player like Suez or other major feedstock partners, they have the access to that waste. So immediately in terms of feedstock availability, it's a lot easier than, for example, going to a local authority and bidding for that waste contract, which is a whole different game with its own complexities.
The Circular Fuels project, it gained planning consent last summer. What stage is the project at now? Can you give any updates about it?
I think I'd start with the precursor to that facility as well. As you may know, we're also working on a precursor demo of taking our existing Sustainable Energy Centre plant in the Midlands and adding a syngas to DME production to that. And that feeds into the Teesside update, hence why I'll start there. So we're pleased to have made significant progress with the construction of that waste to DME add-on demonstrator at our Sustainable Energy Centre in Birmingham, well, close to Birmingham. In 2023, there was a lot of progress made. We've now installed all major items of the plan, including the main DME reactor, alongside, obviously, the existing operational waste to syngas, waste to reform syngas facility next door. Since then, we've, you know, like many others attempting to build new infrastructure at scale, we've faced significant challenges across all parts of our supply chain, which is generally affecting the project as it progresses into its final stages, especially in terms of delivery. However, thanks to the Dimeter partnership and the work we're doing together, we're overcoming these hurdles to ensure the involved parties can adapt and effectively, you know, have a completion date of the demo in the second half of 2024. And in parallel to that, we've also been building on our initial plans for the first of its kind waste to DME facility in Teesside over the course of 2023. So there'd been a lot of project development activities. And we're also very pleased to share that we've invested further into improving efficiencies of that project. And as a result, we'll be now producing over 60,000 tons a year of renewable and recycled carbon DME, which is 20% more than initially announced. And this has resulted, obviously, in further work needing to be undertaken to facilitate this new capacity. And due to that expanded capacity in terms of an overall update on timelines, the new target date for, and also taken into account when the demonstrator facility will be live, we now expect to reach a final investment decision for the production facility in Teesside by the end of 2024, with construction times from on there onwards to have live molecules. But we're really looking forward to the first molecules, both from our existing SEC facility in the coming year. And this will help feed into UK trials of DME and LPG blends, as well as also trials for 100% DME applications. And all of that will contribute to a final investment decision for the project in Teesside and ultimately accelerate the UK LPG industry to achieve its 100% renewable ambitions by 2040.
Hopefully. You did mention a financial decision by the end of the year there. So I have to ask, would you be looking to move to construction quite soon after that?
Yeah, so that would be the intention, yeah. As soon as FID is achieved, and then obviously you have, you know, your contract suites and all the complexity of the lawyers and contracts, then absolutely, shortly following that, it would be planned for construction to start.
You've talked a bit about partnerships there and business deals. Are there any more of those coming along in the future that you can give some insight into?
In terms of sharing actual names, it might be a bit trickier.
That's what everyone says.
But I can give some teasers. In general, we are working on some extremely exciting projects as Q in both. We have a twin commercialization strategy where on one side of the our commercial plans, we focus on industrial co-location. We look at deploying our modular product to co-locate with industry and fuel switch them from natural gas or coal into a syngas alternative, and that syngas alternative can be further upgraded in the future to hydrogen as well. So we've got a lot of interesting projects in the pipeline with some players in the pulp and paper industry, cement industry, and also the glass industry. You might have also seen the news about our work with NSG Pilkington in Greengate, St. Helens, and that's also looking at that, and we're looking to do trials that was funded by the UK Industrial Fuel Switching Programme as well. So that's been really helpful and supportive of, you know, early commercialization and early adopter projects. And then on the other hand, we also have, obviously, you know about the Teesside and the DME project, but we also have other advanced molecule projects in the pipeline around hydrogen. And that's also greatly enabled by the fact that the UK government has funded us around 9.4 million under their greenhouse gas removal and H2BECCS programs to actually add on to our existing facility, syngas to hydrogen and carbon capture production, which is also looking to be operational late 24, early 25. And as a result of that, we'll be producing hydrogen and CO2 molecules from waste. And that's been a key enabler to also adding hydrogen projects to our commercial pipeline that we'd be looking to deploy very soon as well with some equally big hitters in the market.
You've mentioned a couple of times your demonstration scale facility in the Midlands. Back in 2019, I covered it, and now it's become a flagship for your technology. But for gasification technology, it's the scaling up where the problems seem to come. So how do you avoid them?
So it's a very, very good question. I mentioned before, we focused a lot on learning the lessons of a failure, and I talked about two of our co-founders, Kamal and Hans, who played a key role on that. Before addressing the scaling question, I'll start with in terms of the know-how. So demonstrating our know-how and how we've applied that has been core validation through our Sustainable Energy Center plan. And as mentioned, two of our co-founders came from that world and they really knew and understood the complexity of the technical process. through their developments in the IP, technically, we now then had an IP that addressed the historic challenges of TAR and syngas consistency for upgrading into advanced molecules. And then that was complemented by our CTO's experience with regards to taking an innovation from paper into an operational asset in the real world. You know, one of the most crucial steps in innovation in general, and the fact that, you know, theory doesn't always translate perfectly into practice is a huge part of this. Thanks to all of that, and shout out to the Energy Technologies Institute, the ETI, which was a public-private partnership between UK government and the likes of BP, Shell, Rolls-Royce, E.ON, EDF, etc. They really helped. You know, there was over 10 million investment to enable us to begin the construction and the demonstration of what we'd proved to them at pilot scale back in around 2013 to now in 2017-18 when we began the construction, and you covered it in 2019 in terms of initial commissioning. So that's been a journey on its own, and the Sustainable Energy Centre coming along has really helped support our journey. And I'd say it's the most important part of it, to be honest, is the critical path of it all. And to come back to answer your question now, just having given the background of the Sustainable Energy Centre, the fact that we could demonstrate the core technology is one point. The fact that we call it a commercial scale demonstrator is another point. And I'm sure many people have questions as to why we use that exact term. And the reason for that is based on the fact that we're now deploying this as a commercial product. And we call the Sustainable Energy Centre a commercial scale demonstrator facility because actually our modular product is going to be the same scale as our demonstration facility in the Midlands. And the reason for that, and this is where I'm proud to bring and mention our third and final co-founder, our CEO, Kevin Chown, who is a core part in the approach of how we are addressing the scale-up risk. I think everyone knows that scalability is indeed one of innovation's biggest challenges. And when it comes to gasification, you could even say one of its biggest barriers in its history. Kevin's background is from the automotive sector, uniquely actually, but he had a lot of experience in lead manufacturing, etc. And as a result of that, he bought the idea of, let's modularize it. So now that's quite different. And it's also why we sometimes use the term reinventing waste to energy, because in the traditional energy from waste and in the world of biofuels, they typically are large bespoke projects. So bringing a modular solution to that is, I think, quite a game changer. And I think, although not directly linked, I think you can see the way wind and solar deployed and how, you know, modularity and, you know, replication can really enable.
You've mentioned the problems with gasification, and I think you even used the term horror stories. That's a tricky thing when you're trying to sell people the gasification technology. How do you convince them that this is the way forward?
Another very good question. It's probably what's now that as part of the commercial team, I spend a lot of my time doing. And it's actually we focus a lot on that aspect when we first engage stakeholders. And as you can imagine, it's not the most straightforward of a process, but we are slowly but surely achieving what I like to term as simplicity in the complexity. I've probably talked a lot about the Sustainable Energy Centre. I think that is a key enabler to any of our interactions because we're able to demonstrate our core technology at commercial scale successfully on various feedstocks. And again, you know, thanks to that being enabled by the ETI in the earlier days and more recently enabled by our partners Dimeter, this crucially meant that, you know, we can have core proof, core technology validation, and people can come and visit, they can see it working, and we also offer trials to key stakeholders from feedstock partners to other potential clients, and this really plays an important role in convincing people. And that combined with, I have to give a shout out to the whole Q team, you know, from the senior management team and beyond that, we have a team who have multiple previous experiences, they come from different sectors, and the way we're coming together and how hard the team has been working, all the way from the team who've been here longer. So when I first started almost 6 years ago, now there's only about 10 of us. In the last 2 to 3 years, you know, including contractors, that's gone up to 100. The team and their know-how, and then how we apply our know-how and come together and work with clients and stakeholders and investors has also contributed to that. All of that is underpinned by having the know-how of such a complex technical space.
It's good to hear you're growing so well. I wanted to ask, other guests on this podcast have suggested the UK government's financial subsidies for waste gasification, mainly through the CFD and the ROC systems, pushed companies and local authorities to invest in the technology without checking it out enough in the first place. Do you think that's right?
I'd agree to an extent, absolutely, because ultimately it's all about, as we've touched on, scalability risk and technology risk. But I think you all also have to see the other side of it, where innovation will need support, it'll need financial support, it'll need financial pushes. So you can't always be too risk averse. There has to be a risk appetite. So I think that was a good move in terms of showcasing risk appetite. However, that could also backfire in terms of if you have too much risk appetite and get too risky, and then you invest in things that don't go so well, then you will suffer from the backlash of that. And I think SQ, and as I mentioned, I've been in the company now for almost 6 years. 5 years ago, it was a lot harder for us to talk to people about gasification than it is now. And that was also as a result of some of those projects that didn't go so well. But now there's more open-mindedness and people, you know, are recognizing that advanced gasification is a key technology pathway to achieving net zero. It's also one of the very limited technology pathways that can achieve negative carbon. So it needs to be supported. It needs to have some backing. But our philosophy, and it's also the reason of why I've talked, we've gone modular in terms of scale up. And what that means is we can scale up, but instead of scaling up the process, which is painful and difficult and very, very risky, we scale up by having 2, 3, and over 10 modules. And we have projects in the pipeline with corporate partners varying across a wide range of those scales. So I think what my personal view on this is, in terms of policy, and apologies for a slightly cringy term, but policy can tend, and I see this with SAF, if I'm completely honest, to have a go big or go home policy, or push for go big or go home projects. And I think that's actually where it can go very badly wrong, because if you go, you know, go big, that's a huge investment, and that's a lot of time, and not just in investing in the actual project, but investing in the development of the project. That also is extremely complicated when you think about the waste side of it and getting the waste supply chain, which, you know, is challenging in its own right. So I think instead of the focus, especially when it comes to innovation, I think we can really learn the lessons of solar and wind, which started small and, you know, developed into bigger and bigger scales. So my philosophy is all, and Q's philosophy in general has been, start small to build big, you know, prove that it works. Modular is a great way to do it in some cases, but prove that it works, get some commercial traction, get some commercial viability. And also that means you get to develop and deliver projects and CO2 reduction and GHG emissions avoidance impact much sooner. So you get to win in terms of slowly but surely you're proving it out and, you know, commercializing it. You get to win because you're removing CO2 from the atmosphere sooner than later. And then you can invest in R&D of, you know, looking at more at scale-ups. And that's also what Q's doing. We're focusing on modular now, but we definitely do have plans for a scale-up to address, you know, larger scale project requirements, which, you know, you could look at SAF and other molecules that need big projects. But first, you have to de-risk it.
That makes sense. And the modular approach seems a good way forward to me. But you touched on the government policy there, and I think a lot of that is quite up in the air. Maybe the focus is moving away from the environment, with both major parties planning to drop previous green commitments. I'm guessing this must be frustrating for you, isn't it?
I would say yes. Navigating changes in government policy is never easy. And as my own little mini rant, which I'm sure many others in the sector can relate to, especially in the waste-to-X sector, is we have a very hard job of that. But government has been quite supportive, but it's challenging for government and us, because as an advanced gasification technology, as part of advanced conversion technologies, you know, you're interacting with waste policies, you're interacting with energy policies, you're interacting with transport policies, off-grid heating policies, and it's quite difficult to bring that all together. And then also with, you know, emission trading schemes coming up and things like that. But to answer your question in terms of is it frustrating, I'd say navigating changing government policy is challenging in general. Shifts away from environmental commitments, however, do present significant challenges for us, and it underscores the critical nature of our work in advanced gasification. We need to make this commercial. There's obviously the technology risk, which we focused a lot on, but the other side is we need policy stability. We need supportive policies that encourage innovation, and that will help, you know, make projects bankable and encourage investment in those sustainable solutions. So we are focusing a lot on having resilience and being adaptable to the evolving landscape, as it's key to making sure we survive and succeed. But it would be really good to see the evolving landscape start to settle and support the commercialization of technologies like ours.
Let's hope so. I wanted to ask also, you were at COP28 at the end of last year. Is it, as a very prominent critic has said, just blah, blah, blah? Or is it something the waste treatment sector should be more involved in, and should it be more supportive of it?
It would be good to see more support. I was there myself, and there were actually, surprisingly, more waste-to-X conversations than I was expecting. So there were a few panels that covered the topic. There was quite a bit of talk about circular economy, and there was a lot of interest from the Middle East in general for that. And then I also had a follow-up trip to Saudi in January related to this whole shift in circular economy. Personally, I think it would be great to see the waste sector more involved in this, because my main takeaway from that was also in terms of there was a lot of encouragement, whether it was waste or other stuff, in R&D level and innovation level projects and support and funding. However, my view was we need to see, especially in terms of 2050, 2040 is rapidly approaching, and you know there's also 2030 targets that we have to achieve. So I would like to see more focus on solutions that are closer to the market, and more funding and efforts being put into go-to-market solutions that can get there quicker, and by the waste sector participating and bringing acknowledgement that, you know, waste is historically being seen as a challenge and a problem. You know, it generates methane emissions, CO2 emissions. It's not ideal or aligned to us achieving net zero. However, it's also an opportunity in terms of you can use that waste resource to replace fossil fuels. You can use that waste resource to stop replacing electricity as much, because as you can see in the UK, the grid is rapidly decarbonizing, electricity is rapidly decarbonizing, and start focusing that waste resource into addressing the bigger and the shift to, you know, well beyond fossil fuels, as Q likes to term it, by using that same waste resource, producing, you know, hydrogen for transport and industry, producing DME for off-grid heating, producing methanol for maritime and chemicals, producing SAF for aviation. You know, it has endless opportunities, or chemicals for the chemicals industry in general. That being said, I think it will be great to have the waste sector not pick a winner in terms of, you know, which molecule should it focus on? Which molecule should it prioritize? I'm a strong advocate for having a level playing field in terms of there are many hard to abate sectors, from off-grid heating to transport to energy intensive industries. And the waste sector should have an open mind in terms of focusing on how can we maximize carbon reductions and GHG emissions avoidance and take it from there.
I agree. I think that's the best way forward. I wanted to talk about you, if that's okay. You're from more of a commercial background, when a lot of people who are in the waste sector, they come from technical fields like, say, engineering and chemistry. I know you're not directly in the waste sourcing area, but what got you into working with people in the waste sector?
I'm an economics and management graduate, so you're absolutely right. I don't come from a technical background. As a result, just based on my background, I'm one of the minorities in Q as a result of that, because we're mostly brilliant and genius engineers and chemists and industrial chemists and fabulous operating team who also have a technical background. I'm just thinking back to when I was in uni, or before I started uni, when I picked economics, I always thought, you know, I'd graduate and maybe go work for the Big Four, or, you know, go into economics, go into financial services. But I was always passionate about sustainability. When I was doing my undergraduate, I had a placement year. I thought, you know, when I graduate, I can think about, you know, a serious corporate job. I can go into, you know, the financial management services or consultancy or something later on. But why don't I do something that I am quite passionate about for my placement year? And it will also get me the experience. And funnily enough, that's how I came across Q. I graduated from Aston University, and Q had an advert on the Aston Futures website. And in the title, it had a world beyond fossil fuels. And I kid you not, that's all it took for me to apply and say, okay, I'm actually quite interested. What's this about? And somehow then I ended up almost 6 years later, here I am still, you know, growing with the team and growing with the company. But I would say it's quite unnatural because I don't see many from a similar background to me. It'd be great to see more. I don't know if that's just my own experience or if it's a general experience, but it's not easy, but it's a lot of fun. And I've had a lot of support from not just the internal Q team, but a lot of the stakeholders we work with. So it's been a good experience. But to conclude, I'd say as an ethnic minority young woman who also wears a headscarf, I do bring a unique perspective to the waste sector. And generally, whilst there's progress made, there's still work to be done to ensure, you know, all forms of diversity are embraced and represented. And I hope that by me being out there, it encourages more people like me to also join the journey.
I hope so. I hope so. The majority of the guests I have on here do look like me. Do you think maybe the waste sector, does it do enough to encourage diversity of all kinds?
It could do more, but I think it's also, it might not just be because of the gender aspect of it or the, you know, the ethnic diversity, which I think a lot more could be done on, you know, fostering inclusivity and actively seeking diverse voices and perspective where, you know, which will help the waste sector reflect the communities it serves and drive positive change. But I think actually big reason that plays into why that is also the general perception of waste isn't just wheelie bins or, you know, mountains of landfill. It's just, it has sometimes, I feel like, a bit of a not the most positive connotation. So people are slightly off put by the general perception of waste. And as a result of that, it doesn't attract enough young talent. It doesn't do the best. So I think there's a few of the waste majors who serve a good example of how to attract great talent. And I think a lot can be learned from those who are doing it right now and doing it really well, and building on that as a collective sector voice to encourage it together.
You only joined Q because you happened to see their advert on the thing. Is Q still doing that? Are they doing more things to get more young people in? Because as you say, the waste sector, it's not got the most attractive image to maybe a graduate or a school leaver who's not sure what they want to do, but they've got an interest in sustainability. So how can you convince them to come in?
We still do. In fact, last year or the year before, we recruited about 7 graduates across mainly the engineering disciplines and 2 in the commercial disciplines. And the way we do that is we actually are more proactive in working more closely with local universities. And what we do is, as well as advertising on website university job websites like Aston Futures for Aston University, we also work with the professors and the lecturers and ensure that they receive job opportunities and share that with their fellow students. And sometimes when needed, we can also engage in certain lectures and show, you know, what we're actually doing. But I do think in the waste to X spaces, it's very exciting because we bring the world of waste and oil and gas. So that has its own uniqueness and attractiveness to it. And, you know, slowly but surely, the waste sector, I think the more we work on it together, the more we'll get there.
Hopefully. And I think that's a good point to come to the last question I ask everyone on The Burning Issue. It's, what's the question I should have asked you? And more importantly, how would you have answered it?
Another great question. One of the hardest questions I've been asked, I think, on this podcast now. But I'd just thinking quickly, I'd say ETS comes to my mind. I think the emission trading scheme, and especially with reference to the waste sector and how it's expanding to include the waste sector, is one of the most prominent policy issues which we're trying to navigate through. And there's some lack of clarity, more so with regards to advanced conversion technologies and, you know, which are an emerging form of waste treatment technology, and how they can be included or how they'll be treated under it. In terms of how I would have answered it, probably asked you to ask that question to more people as well, so we can hear more insights and understand what others are thinking. There's obviously some consultations going on, but as a emerging technology developer, we're very keen to work with policy and other fellow developers and waste players in the market to have a unified voice as to how the ETS should be implemented in the waste sector, but also how it should treat emerging technologies which are not as commercial as other traditional EFW solutions and are starting out. But ultimately, the ETS is there to help drive carbon reductions, to help drive GHG emissions avoidance. And I think that is another crucial aspect that should be considered, and focusing on, okay, it's all about waste and what molecule it produces, but more importantly, how does that address harder to abate sectors? So, you know, looking at transport, off-grid heating, cooking fuels and chemicals industries, etc. So, yeah, to summarize, I think ETS is a big topic. We'd like to, you know, work with, you know, other fellow developers and closely with policy to gain more clarity and quicker, because it's causing a lot of challenges in the development of projects right now due to the uncertainty. But that's just a full circle to my point about it's not just ETS policy, it's other policies that we need to have more clarity around and more certainty in order to have bankable projects and start deploying our technology and having impact.
I really like that answer. And you're right. I'm sorry, you did mention ETS earlier on and I didn't ask you about it again. So I'm really glad you gave me that answer. I'd never really thought about the advanced conversion technologies taken separately to, say, a great base DFW plant and all slapped into the ETS. And it's only 4 years away, isn't it?
Yes, it's not very far away. And I will not bore a fellow audience with carbon accounting methodologies, but I think it's also closely linked to the fact that the waste sector does not have a standardized carbon accounting methodology. And that, combined with the fact that ETS is now coming into play, has made it even harder, not just for existing technologies, even more so for emerging technologies, to understand, okay, where do we fit in? How do we fit in? What is our, you know, impact in terms of economics, in terms of carbon accounting methodologies that we can use or can't use? And then just as a general point, that's a very challenging space in terms of you can make hydrogen or transport fuels like SAF, but they could have slightly different carbon accounting methodologies, where DFT lead on the RTFO carbon accounting methodology, DESNA's lead on the low carbon hydrogen standard methodology, which actually are quite similar, but there is risk that there could be divergence. So I guess my final key message is Q Technology is a key player in this sector. We would really like to see standardization of this to enable bankable projects and enable us to develop impact a lot sooner and a lot more impactfully.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think that's a great way to end. Amna, I just want to say thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
All that's left for me to say is thank you very much for listening. If you've liked what you've heard, please share it with your networks, either in person or on socials. It's all really appreciated. And if you want to know more about the waste sector and energy from waste in particular, go to the website endswasteandbioenergy.com, where you can sign up for our free newsletters or take out a subscription if you want to. Goodbye.